On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to today's Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. And my thanks yesterday to Paul Kennedy, the inestimable Paul Kennedy. Actually, no, he's not inestimable. He's very estimable. But the wonderful Paul Kennedy for presenting yesterday's Conversation Hour for you. While I was off, I had to go to court. My co-host for today's Conversation Hour, where you shall shortly learn about pseudocopulation, is Hilary Harper. Hilary is our Saturday's presenter on ABC Radio Melbourne Victoria and a rather handy person to have around the place. Morning to you, Hilary.
Morning, John. You make it sound like I carry a toolbox, which in fact I do, but it is a kind of grammar nerd toolbox. I guess that's probably my bag.
A cerebral toolbox.
Yes. Thank you, John. That's a lovely way to put it.
But an emotional one too.
Okay. Now, am I a counsellor or how's this?
Yeah, you're one of those around here that's handy around the place when someone needs a bit of TLC.
Oh, God, I'm going to have wet shoulders for the rest of my working life. That's funny, actually, because someone said, oh, Hilary, you're such a den mother, when I was in my first shared house of, you know, my 20s. And I was like, no, don't say that. It's so daggy. And now it's like, yeah, I embrace that. It's fine. Every single workplace I've ever been in, that is my role. It was quite weird becoming an actual parent. It's much simpler, actually, when they start small, isn't it?
Yeah, you can shape them.
Yeah, and you don't have to start with the high-level counselling, but you don't get to say goodbye to them at the end of the day.
No, they just sort of annoy you at 3 a.m. as well.
Yeah, mine have stopped doing that, but
they're
going through that phase where you find them in the hallway 20 minutes after you put them to bed. And if you're lucky, they're asleep in the hallway and they've just made the floorboards really warm. It's hilarious. Or they made a little can of stuffed toys and kind of flopped themselves on it.
Yeah, cuddling up with the special one,
exactly.
Little cuddly dog or something.
It's, in my case, the smaller one has adopted a crocodile for some reason. I don't know what that says about my parenting.
What, stuffed crocodile?
It's a stuffed crocodile. It's a soft, fluffy crocodile.
Oh, fluffy.
Makes such a thing?
Not an actual crocodile, taxidermied.
No, John, no. Even in my household, a three-year-old would probably not be given a taxidermied crocodile.
I had one.
Really? You, John Fain, had a taxidermy. Did you take it to bed?
Yep.
Why?
I wonder where it went.
I wonder many things about that scenario. How did you get your hands on it, for starters?
It was given to me.
What did it feel like when you snuggled it at night?
Sharp.
Does this explain a lot about your life choices subsequently?
Prickly.
Going into the law?
No, I had two toys. One was a little koala with one ear.
Yeah.
They were little rubber paws and rubber ears.
Yes, also sharp.
Yeah, no, floppy.
Oh, okay.
But, and that got left behind somewhere on a holiday, I can't remember, and I didn't sleep for 2 nights because I'd never slept without my fluffy koala.
And that was before the time when, for example, to pick an example at random, you would get a panicked call from your sister-in-law at 10 o'clock at night going, where did you find that donkey that the kids have? Because we need another one now.
Where's the blankie?
The blankie. Oh, yeah. My brother had a blankie that didn't get washed for about a month.
Yeah, disgusting. It's disgusting. Yeah.
So yeah, that was your one toy, and the other one was this.
The crocodile.
So
it was very small. It was about maybe in the old measure, 12 or 15 inches long.
Yes, that's small for a crocodile, but large for a taxidermied object that you take to bed with you as a small child.
Yeah.
Was taxidermy a hobby within your family?
Not at all.
Where did it come from, John?
No idea. Can't remember. Someone gave it to me.
So, John, your life is turning out like a series of unfortunate events.
What's unfortunate about it? Why do you assume that a crocodile was unfortunate?
Why do I assume that a small child being given an animal with sharp teeth and claws to take to bed that kills people is unfortunate? Yes.
Might have been a freshie, not a salty.
Is this why you posited me as the counsellor of the workplace before we started this conversation? I'm feeling a bit manipulated.
Freshies don't kill people, and if they're only about 12 to 15 inches long, they're actually quite cute.
So it was a natural history exercise.
And it had glass eyes.
They all did back then. I had a lamb called Lamb Chops.
There you are, see?
I grew up in the country. There was no dissembling.
Are you now a vegetarian?
No. I miss Lamb Chops. I very early on learnt to hold the two ideas in my mind of cuddling the lamb and eating the lamb.
Yeah.
Even the words were the same.
I had to go to court yesterday, and then we had a celebratory lunch afterwards, and it was to do with my niece becoming a lawyer, and I got to move the motion for her admission at the Supreme Court, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, and how did you qualify for that honour?
Well, you only have to be an Australian lawyer.
Oh.
And then you are eligible to move. It's a ceremonial sitting, so right. You don't have to have a current practicing certificate to do it.
So although RAKE could do it.
Most people do. Hey,
RAKE could do it.
RAKE should have a current practicing certificate. Okay. In fact, but it's ceremonial. It's kind of fun, and it's a great honour to be asked. Of course,
congratulations, John.
And then you go for lunch.
Obviously,
she's vegan.
What did you do, John? Did you keep your mouth shut?
We all had vegan lunch.
And what was it?
Vegan stuff?
No, John.
What was it? Okay, burnt broccoli.
Be petulant about it, but...
Burnt broccoli with some nuts chopped up and put on top.
Are we talking like char-grilled caramelised broccoli or just yeah. John scoffing?
Burnt broccoli. Some actually, kind some of it was product. Really nice. It was fancy vegan. And,
yes.
My 92-year-old dad, who was sitting next to me, was sitting there going, sort of poking it around on the plate a bit. I think he was wondering if he could look over his shoulder and order a steak. But
I remember the time when Mum started using TVP, textured vegetable protein,
yes.
in the mince dishes. And it took Dad quite some time to twig
yeah.
the shepherd's pie.
There were some beautiful wonton-y things with I don't know what stuffing. But, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, vegan stuff has come a long way. Well, apparently, there's a fish and chip shop in Stroud in the UK that now serves tofu. Fish and chips, which what? Is battered tofu.
Styrofoam?
No, it's softer than that.
Battered styrofoam?
Even the texture of tofu products has come a long way, John.
Battered deep fried styrofoam.
We were talking the other day about the whole concept of not bacon and things like that.
Yeah.
Why do you make something that looks like meat?
Well, Esther was talking about, you know what a turducken is?
Yes, I do.
Turkey stuffed with duck stuffed with chicken.
And it's also a metaphor.
There's also a vegan equivalent now.
Oh, no.
Which
tempeh stuffed with...
equally ridiculous. Anyway, the meal was delicious. The event was wonderful. It was all good fun and everybody had a great time.
Excellent stuff.
But it then led to a very vigorous discussion about whether alcohol is vegan.
Doesn't it depend... Oh, is it because of the organisms that ferment?
Yes.
Yeah, this...
And, believe this or not, and someone hit the phone and Googled to prove it, a lot of alcohol is filtered through fish bones.
Oh, that's horrible. When you say alcohol, do you just mean wine? Or?
No, even spirits and all sorts of things. So we worked out very quickly that, you know, some of those spirits that have little worms and things in them, like tequilas and the like, obviously aren't. But
you've got to go for the vodka with the strip of grass. Much better.
Yeah, and then we kind of decided that... to hell with it. That's where you can draw the line anyway.
I bet you drew the line much earlier than that.
Might have.
Now, John, my anniversary is coming up. My 8th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. The relationship has gone on for much longer. Hmm. And my husband is notoriously difficult to get good gifts for. He has eclectic taste, but it's more working out which gift is going to slot neatly into that little need that he might have.
Need?
Well, you know.
Gifts aren't about need, are they?
Are they not, John?
No.
Is the taxidermied crocodile not about some kind of need that was there?
No,
I
not
think
at all.
You're wrong.
No.
Anyway.
I developed an affection for it out of nothing.
Out of nothing.
Mm.
I think you need to have developed an affection for it before it goes into the bed to be snuggled.
There's
something
need,
going on.
Need coming out again.
Yes, I know. I'm the counsellor here, John. Stop.
No.
Anyway, one year
quite happy to turn the tables.
I got him a movie poster of his very favourite movie, which is The Sweet Smell of Success, and that is beautiful, isn't it?
This is like an old original poster.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Because there's the newspaper from the day you were born, all that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Someone gave me one of those once, I think for my 50th.
There's nothing that exciting about a newspaper from 1969.
I don't know. It depends what day it was.
Maybe, yeah. No, anyway, I think that I can count on the
69.
Fingers of one hand.
That's Moon landing was 69.
Probably not around him when he was born, though.
How do you know?
I bet it was one of those slow news days.
Oh,
except for the excitement
up.
Of my husband's birth. It would be like, oh, I don't know,
you want me to look
budget
it up?
Passes. No. So the 8th anniversary, you know, they have those lists of anniversary presents. They have these traditional lists where, you know, the first anniversary is paper.
Right.
And the 8th is pottery or bronze. And I cannot imagine anything made of bronze that my husband would like. But it really got me looking at all the different things. Like the 9th is willow. Who makes this stuff up? And, John, I've been
willow,
to your house.
Cricket bat.
And the 42nd anniversary one is clocks. How many 42nd anniversaries have you had, John?
None. Well, 42nd birthday I have, yeah.
Well.
It's not an anniversary, no.
I think you've been stocking up.
We had a cull of clocks.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
How did that feel, John?
Oh, once you get your head to it. Yeah, they used to be rather, they breed.
Yes, and people give them to you because once they've worked out that niche, that need.
But they weren't, I very quickly want people to realise that they weren't expensive clocks. In fact, they were mostly novelty and silly clocks. Clocks that had moving eyes and things like that.
Mickey Mouse clocks.
Mickey Mouse clocks and cuckoos and silly things like that. Yeah, they just sort of got a bit, it got a bit silly. So lots of them are in boxes now. If anyone wants a cuckoo clock, just give me a call.
So were the clocks about control, John?
No.
Were they about being predictable?
I think you're going too far here.
This is really fun. You'd be an amateur psychologist.
It's just a bit silly, really. It's just a bit of silliness.
Yes, indeed. Well, and the 33rd anniversary is iron. I thought, well, that's you all over. 29th, tools.
Hey.
Yeah, now we're talking. There's only so many car parts you can fit in one house, I guess.
Yeah. In one garage.
Yes, clearly I meant
that.
I nearly
tripped over the other day.
Over?
Just too much rubbish out there. Can't turn around.
So you've done a cull of the house, but not the garage.
Oh, yeah, I've got to sell some parts.
Okay. Do you have one of those garages with a board with every tool outlined and neatly in its place?
No.
Why not?
Where do you want me to start?
I think of you as having that kind of tool. How do you find things?
You just know where they are because that's where you put it.
And because no one else ever goes in there and moves a tool half an inch.
Well, no, they do. In fact, there was a time when I went out to use some tools and they weren't there. And I thought, oh, damn it, so-and-so's borrowed it. And so after a week or so, I went, can I have my blah, blah back? And they went, no, I haven't got it. And I went, oh, in that case, someone else has borrowed it. So it was, in fact, elder son. Can I have my blah, blah, blah? He said, I haven't got it. I said, well, who else has? And then the penny dropped that, in fact, someone had broken into the garage and stolen a whole lot of tools.
Yeah, see, this is the only reason why people should organise their houses, because then you can see when things have been stolen. I had a friend of a friend once who organised his CD collection. Remember those? For alphabetically, and someone broke in one day and stole S to Z. So they left him with everything before that. Entire chunks of everything were gone.
S to Z.
Yeah.
They lost all their Tom Waits.
Yeah. And they're violent femmes, John.
Oh, well, there you go. There's a lesson. We're going to talk pseudocopulation with our next guest, Danielle Claude, who's written a book about the discoverer of pseudocopulation. And no, it's not erotic and it's not lewd. It's in fact all about orchids and the extraordinary, remarkable life of the naturalist Edith Coleman, who discovered pseudocopulation, which is how orchids reproduce. Well, maybe it is a bit erotic. Danielle Claude, our first guest on The Conversation Hour, in just a moment with Hilary Harper, my co-host. I'm John Fain. This is The Conversation Hour on your ABC. Danielle Claude is a zoologist and an author who's written a book about the remarkable life of the Australian naturalist Edith Coleman. The book is called The Wasp and the Orchid. Danielle, good morning to you. Congratulations.
Good morning, John.
Can you explain pseudocopulation for those who have been held in suspense since I first mentioned it?
Well, it is a strange term, and it does have a broad range of forms, in zoology at least. So, you know, when frogs mate, they call that pseudocopulation because there's no actual internal fertilisation going on. So copulation is where there's internal fertilisation. But with this particular case,
one frog lays the egg and the other one fertilises it already when it's out.
Yes, they look like they're mating, but in actual fact what they're doing is fertilising the eggs as they come out.
So how do orchids use that?
Well, orchids are a little bit different because they don't use another orchid. They're actually enlisting a different species to perform this pseudocopulation. So like most flowers attract insects to help them to cross-fertilise, to transfer pollen from one flower to another.
And using that's a bee or whatever.
A bee or a fly or a beetle or birds or all sorts of different animals. So that's what flowers are all about. And that's why plants have flowers. The flowers are specifically to attract pollinators. Plants that don't use pollinators don't have fancy flowers. They're very small and simple. So it's been a long puzzle for biologists as to why orchids have such spectacular flowers. Not all orchids, but some orchids have spectacular flowers and they don't produce any nectar. And nectar is the reward that you give to pollinators for taking the pollen. So most of the time that the insects and animals are going there for nectar. And these orchids have none. So nobody knew how that worked and what they were getting out of the deal.
So how did Edith work it out? I mean, lots of people have studied wasps over the years and orchid people are crazy and numerous, so that's happened a lot as well. How did she pick it?
Crazy, are they?
Interesting. They're passionate and interesting, John.
They are indeed, yes. I think Edith was, it was a great mystery. I mean, it was one of the great mysteries that Darwin struggled over. Darwin was desperately unhappy about not being able to solve this mystery. I think one of the tricks is that there's only a few groups of orchids that do this particular behaviour, and there's only one genera in Europe that does it, but there's a lot of them in Australia. So Australia's really a bit of a hothouse for deception and mimicry and all sorts of strange activities in biology. So Edith was lucky in that she was in the right place, but she was also highly observant. So if you think about most orchidologists, they used to collect orchids and they'd squash them and press them between two bits of paper and classify them and put them into a, you know, scientific paper. Edith was more interested in watching them and seeing what happened in the wild. And she actually, in her case, she picked the orchids, popped them in a vase so she could draw them or look at them, which we don't encourage anymore, but at the time that was a fairly normal thing to do. And she observed, or her daughter Dorothy actually observed, wasps entering the orchids. But the strange thing was they were doing it backwards. Now, that's not something you normally do if you're after nectar.
And there was a weird little kind of jig that they did as well.
Yes, they were definitely behaving very strangely. So that led her to do a number of studies to actually work out what they were doing.
What's the backward wasp doing in my orchid?
Indeed.
And the answer is?
And the answer is it's mating with the orchid. So she, with her investigation, she very soon found that all the wasps were male. They weren't eating anything. They weren't laying eggs or doing anything. So she ruled out all the other possible options.
They were just getting their rocks off.
They were definitely getting their rocks off. And she also demonstrated, within the limits of the technology she had available, that they were ejaculating on the orchids as well. That's actually only recently been proven to be the case.
And this, the way you're describing what she's doing, it makes it sound like she is a scientist. But this was in a backyard and in Blackburn, wasn't it?
Mm.
And a woman who, until she was in her late 40s, had never pursued any scientific endeavour.
Mm. Well, that's the interesting thing. She didn't start her academic, well, not an academic career, but her scientific career until she was 48, and she appeared at the Field Naturalist Club of Victoria, presented a paper on orchids, which was met with huge interest. In fact, the next person to speak had to be adjourned until the next meeting because there was so much discussion about this fascinating paper. And she published on orchids for a couple of years before she started her work on pseudocopulation. And within a year or two, she was met with international acclaim for having resolved this great mystery. So to go from, as you say, you know, a housewife in Blackburn to an internationally acclaimed orchid expert is a pretty remarkable thing for a woman with no training in the subject matter, no affiliation with any university.
When you say international acclaim, it was localised and temporary international acclaim of a kind I guess we wouldn't think of. Like, she wasn't having parades in the streets. She wasn't, you know, front page of the newspapers.
It's scientific acclaim.
Yes.
So, and that is actually extremely hard to get. Scientists are incredibly conservative. That particular period was not all that friendly to women, so there was quite a lot of opposition to women moving into these areas, although botany is a field that women do tend to do well in. But nonetheless, there was still a lot of restrictions. I was, as a scientist myself, I was actually quite surprised at the positive response to her work. She really did manage to persuade people enormously quickly of the value of her work. And
as an amateur, despite being an amateur. And we're talking about, she was in suburban, what's suburban Blackburn, but then was regarded as semi-rural.
Yes, it was a garden suburb.
In the 1930s. The 1930s, having settled there in the late 20s.
Yes, earlier, yes. She'd been there for quite a few years. She'd raised her family there.
Now, I promise not to be distracted by this, but she came from a remarkable family, indeed, in many regards, and her husband was remarkable and worthy of study entirely in his own right.
You can have two minutes on this, John, no more.
Time's running.
James was a really interesting person. So he was one of the pioneering motorists in Victoria, so he was the first person to sell motorcycles in Victoria.
And race them.
And race them, yes. He was very keen on racing.
And they looked like they still had pedals.
They were very basic motorcycles. Yeah, they're not much different.
Started them by pedalling them.
Did you?
Yeah, to get them compression and get them firing.
It was a bicycle with a motor.
A primary chain and a secondary chain. Yep.
Oh, that's
so. He
good
was
to know.
A he was a bike seller. He used to sell bikes, and I think that's probably how he met Edith. Edith came into the shop to buy a bike, so just a push bike. But he also was a pioneer of importing cars from France and England over to Australia. And he was also the founder of the one of the founders of the RACV. So he and two of his friends got together and set up the RACV. But he was very much a man who didn't put himself forward. For example, he actually wrote the rule in the RACV that said that nobody who works in this industry can be on the board of the RACV. So he ruled himself out of any
position. To stop it being... So it was a motorists'
yes.
club, not a motor industry club.
That's right.
Club.
Mm. And the picture that caught John's interest
well,
was...
I opened your book and there was a 1925 5CV baby Citroen, or what's called a Trefl, and there she is sitting in the driver's seat even though she never drove. And
well,
there are
yes.
a few of these around, these old 1920s little 5CV Citroens, Citroens.
Yes, it's an interesting photo. I've not been able to establish that she did drive. She may have, but she certainly didn't do it very much. And her daughter, her daughter Dorothy was a very keen driver and she used to drive her on most of her excursions, and she did say that she drove a lot with her husband as well, especially in the early years.
Yes, in the windscreenless years, yes. Right up the back.
Yes, there's no indication that Edith was particularly fond of the cars. She thought that they were useful, but she certainly wasn't an enthusiast. And similarly, James was very supportive of her field work and all of her activities, but I don't think he was particularly interested in it either. So
my 2 minutes is up. She not only got involved with orchids and scientific exploration, but she was also one of the first people to go to the Central Desert to Indigenous communities. What an extraordinary thing in the 1930s.
It was actually not so uncommon at the time. There was actually quite a lot. I think especially the arrival of cars, people were taking cars out across the desert, but it was a very early thing to do. So I think probably her contribution to that is the fact that she wrote about the plants of that area. And that was really, it's quite striking that this woman who grew up in England had a passionate love of English gardens and, you know, beautiful lush green things, could go into that environment and
to Hermannsburg, of all places, one of the missions, yeah.
And appreciate that landscape and those plants and that ecology for what it was. She really had quite a remarkable sensitivity to the ecology of places.
But she must also, therefore, have also had a very open mind.
I think she did, yes, certainly. And a very questioning mind about how things worked.
What I found really interesting was you said that, you know, it was an unfriendly environment in the late 19th century for women in scientific circles, and yet there were a lot of women battering at the doors to try and get in, and a lot of women writing articles. And that number actually, the proportion went down in the early 20th century.
Mm.
What's going on there? Is it because you used to have women of the leisured class who had servants who had the time to go off and ramble and be naturalists, and later on things changed socioeconomically and women were more burdened by household tasks, or is it something else going on?
I think it is to do with professionalisation. I think particularly in Edith's case, I was struck by the lack of opposition she had, but of course she was operating in an amateur field. I suspected if she had been attempting to get lectureships at Melbourne University, she would have met a lot more opposition and she wouldn't have got very far. So in effect, she achieved what she did by not competing with men. And they're quite, you know, most of the men she worked with were quite happy to collaborate with her purely on an intellectual level. But I think that, you know, the universities were quite restricted in who they'd let in. And once you have jobs that people are competing for and status and position, then that becomes a much tougher environment.
Well, and she was even recorded, one of her specimens was recorded as being donated under her husband's name, and that led to some confusion, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it did. I was a little bit excited when I found all of these specimens that were collected by J.G. Coleman, because I had no evidence that he'd ever participated in any of her orchid work. But then when I actually went and looked at the specimens themselves, you could see that it was Mrs. J.G. Coleman, and then that had been mistranscribed as J.G. Coleman on the electronic database. But the interesting thing is that the person who... She didn't write Mrs. J.G. Coleman. Her collaborator, Rupp, wrote that. And you can see that he's actually rubbed that out and written Edith. So he's almost recognised that this is a bad thing to do.
Well, times have changed.
Yeah, yeah.
Times have changed. And indeed, one of her grandchildren who you got onto was very excited that finally she was getting some recognition, which otherwise just would not have happened. It emphasised to me, as you told your own story of discovering her story, just how random history can be.
Yes, when you look into these stories, you often realise how important it is that other people protect and promote the work of the people who've gone before them. So you need to have somebody who's actually, you know, like Mary Shelley promoted Byron and Percy Shelley's work. Without her work at publishing, transcribing, getting their poetry and work out to the public domain, they would have become quite obscure rather than the famous poets we know them as. And Edith didn't have that. Both of her daughters were quite reclusive and private. And they didn't see it as being anybody else's business. So as a result, we've lost a lot of her records.
I would like to ask briefly about the fact that you grew up sailing around on what your family called a pirate ship.
I guess that probably is responsible for, you know, my passion for nature.
And your eye patch.
And my eye patch, yeah, and my wooden leg. But, yeah, so, yeah, my parents were very keen on living on the sea and getting away from the constraints of civilised life. And
hippies?
Yeah, of a sort. Certainly alternative lifestylers, for sure.
And now?
My dad still has a boat, yes. He lives in New Zealand. But yeah.
On the boat?
Not so much. He'd like to, but...
Did it leave a scarred daughter?
No, it was a marvellous childhood. It was absolutely, yeah, a magnificent childhood. I couldn't imagine anything better.
And you ended up in the Shetland studying feral mink?
Yeah, in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland I did my field work. Yes, I do like to get away from...
Which island?
mostly on Harris, so in the middle.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. It's a lovely place.
It is. It's extraordinarily beautiful. Congratulations on a wonderful book too, and Daniel Clode has told the story of the story as much as anything else, but it's particularly the remarkable life of Australian naturalist Edith Coleman, who, living in what then was a semi-rural Blackburn, discovered that wasps and orchids cooperated on pseudo-copulation in order for orchids to reproduce. It's an amazing story, The Wasp and the Orchid by Daniel Clode, Clode. And I might say congratulations to your book designers who have done a beautiful job.
They have indeed.
And there's lots of extracts of Edith's work and writing in the book, along with all the rest of it and lots of illustrations as well, including some beautiful orchids. Daniel Clode, the book is called The Wasp and the Orchid. And Daniel will be speaking at a bookshop in Eltham, the Eltham Bookshop. Is there but one?
Yes.
At the Eltham Bookshop tonight at 6:30. How appropriate. Should be speaking in Blackburn too.
Yes, it's not far from there.
So. Not too far. Congratulations. Congratulations to you, Daniel Clode. The book is called The Wasp and the Orchid. Coming up next, how important is music to the cultural and therefore also the economic life of a city? Well, that's something that the bassist from the Violent Femmes and shakuhachi player Brian Ritchie is going to join us, together with Sound Diplomacy's Shane Shapiro. They're concerned to the point where it's become almost something of a conference paper to look at how you go about ensuring the role of music in the life of a city. And they join us next here on The Conversation Hour with Hilary Harper, my co-host here on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria Digital Radio and the We're joined in the studio by Brian Ritchie and Shane Shapiro. Shane's the founder and managing director of something called Sound Diplomacy. Morning to you, Shane. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And Brian Ritchie, whose work may be known to you through the Violent Femmes or his shakuhachi performance, is also curating what's called Dark Mofo down in the booming metropolis of Hobart, which is going to be looking at some of these issues as well. And these issues are about a music city, what makes for a music city. Brian, why are some cities successful music cities and others are not?
Well, it used to be either it would just organically grow, like in New Orleans or Chicago became a big music city because a lot of black immigrants moved from the South and then they started playing blues and that created a whole scene. But this conference is more about actually trying to facilitate cities becoming better music cities through various interventions and actions, which... Yeah, I guess you could probably tell them more about that.
Shane, you couldn't get more music into a city than Melbourne's already got, could you? You just couldn't squeeze it into the edges.
Melbourne has a lot of music, yes. And I think there was a study done that said that Melbourne had more music venues per capita than any other city. I think what we think about when it comes to a music city is we think about a city that puts music at the heart of its policy infrastructure, like it would put anything else. And as I said, music kind of grew, music developed in cities in an organic way. And unfortunately now, it's still developing organically, but it's a lot harder for musicians to, you know, to develop careers, let alone, you know, there's less, you know, there's less opportunities for people to learn music and experience music, you know, with focuses on STEM instead of STEAM and in terms
STEM,
of education.
Science, technology, engineering and maths.
And
if you add in the arts, you could turn STEM into STEAM.
You turn STEM into STEAM. And so what we tried to do is the purpose of the convention is to outline that there's kind of a deliberate and intentional way to embed music into places. It's not about what kind of music. It's simply about embedding the policy, getting the soil right so the plants grow.
But if you get, engineered, manufactured music, is that not as good as organically occurring music?
It's not about what's good or bad. It's for me, there's no value judgments in relation to the type of music or anything related to that. It's I believe that every city needs to treat music as, you know, as an economic driver as well as a tourism driver and something that's important for our health and social care and cultural well-being.
And social care, that's interesting because we've all seen, you know, AC/DC Lane and we've seen people having their wedding photos in alleyways around bars and stuff. Melbourne gets that. But health and social policy, how do we embed that?
Well, music. There's 50 years of scientific evidence that proves that music is good for us. Let alone, music triggers different sensory and electrical nodes in our brain when we're growing up and learning music, which, by the way, is our only universal language. That's the one language that everybody speaks. Learning music triggers different cognitive abilities. Let alone, when someone has dementia or Alzheimer's, usually they can hear us. They remember a song, but they may not remember the face of a relative. And we look at music as a you know, I call it a birth to death policy. Is a city needs to understand that music is a tool to make a place better. And if we think about it, if we plan it, we say build it in rather than bolt it on. That is how we can really understand the role of music in our city. That's the whole purpose of the conference that's happening.
Brian, what nodes were sparked in your brain in Milwaukee way back in the day when you started getting into music?
Survival. It was the only thing that I was interested in. It saved my life. Having music was the only thing that kept me even going to school. Otherwise, I probably would have been a dropout and a criminal. So it's a very important thing for some people. I'm one of those people, but everybody likes music to some degree. And what Shane said about how it improves your mental acuity, as spaced out as musicians seem, the science does show that that it works, and that students who study music or play music, they do better in their other academic subjects. And also, that was interesting what Shane mentioned about Alzheimer's and dementia. We just had a musical event, a festival, mini festival, called The Art of Aging at Mona down in Tasmania, which concentrated exactly on this topic. And we had big band and swing dancing and various things to bring. And we brought a lot of people from the aged care facilities on site to enjoy that, and found that it was triggering a lot of positive emotions in an otherwise probably pretty neglected group of people.
I was seeing some amazing footage recently of people with Parkinson's, and they would play music from their youth and suddenly they could move smoothly again. It was unbelievable, you know. It was like a switch had been flicked and they could access those memories, body memories again through the music.
There's you know, we tell stories through music every day. I'm just thinking about the movie Coco. The movie Coco is a perfect example of the kids movie that won Oscars. I watched it on a plane. It made me cry. I'll be honest. It was because it was brilliant how the the grandmother character recognized her husband because her great grandson was playing a song that he wrote. And this is let alone I believe that when it comes to other mental health deficiencies, depression, anxiety, all of those things, which is part of the music industry as much as it's part of any other industry. We believe we need to think about this. We need to understand its role in society more in order for it to be more impactful.
But the reason why Melbourne has a vibrant music culture is nothing to do with any of the things that either of you have actually mentioned. The reason is because of our liquor licensing laws and the fact that we weren't captive to the pokies and club mentality of New South Wales and Queensland. So Melbourne became this incredibly welcoming, fertile breeding ground because of what it wasn't as much as what it was.
It's also about kids in bedrooms, though, really interested in music. There's something going on in the culture that obviously, you know, needs an outlet for performance, but
sure,
I think there's more going on there.
The outlet for performance was there because the scene wasn't dominated by pokies, clubs, RSLs, yeah, as it was everywhere up the East Coast.
Well, it's true that, I mean, if you look at the reaction to Sydney's lockout laws, ooh, and they're actually losing quite a bit of credibility up there, and Melbourne is gaining because of a healthier attitude towards music.
If anyone wants to make it their career, you really have to come to Melbourne now because Sydney can't support.
Or Tasmania.
How's Tassie going? Because all the young people are fleeing.
It's booming, but it's still tight.
It's booming, and now we're seeing a reversal of the brain drain. There are a lot of people moving back. A lot of people who might have otherwise left are staying because they perceive that there are more opportunities for them in music and other art forms.
Is that home for you now?
Oh, yeah. I've been there for 12 years and love it. It's fantastic. But a healthy music city, it's not only the clubs and the commercial music venues. It also includes non-commercial activity, you know, music in churches or mm-hmm. music on the street, a healthy busking scene.
Choirs.
You know, you can just go down the list of all the different ways that music can, live music can enter people's lives and existences, and that's when you find a healthy music city.
Yeah, the whole purpose and the policy argument is really important. You're saying, why is Melbourne arguably more successful than other cities? And the decision not to create policy is still a policy decision. And so we're discussing that. There will be a lot of, I would say, more on the less sexy side of the industry. There's a lot of discussions that are going to be happening at the event about how regulation in and of itself is a tool to grow music. And sometimes not regulating is as important as regulating.
Pseudo-regulation, like pseudo-copulation.
Well, and speaking of the sexy side of things, just to do it from pseudo-copulation for a minute, Melbourne has a great music culture, but it also has some pretty ordinary stuff happening in bars. Like there's been a wave of revelations in the wake of Me Too about mm-hmm. the treatment of women and lots of people of different diverse backgrounds in bars and live music scenes. You, I know, address that. How do you fix that?
I one of the things that we work on as well is what we would call evening and nighttime economy issues, which I always go back to trying to get people to behave. And, you know, I think it's a bigger discussion. I think it starts in our schools. It starts in our education system. And I think that if we prioritize art and culture alongside other subjects, we're creating kinder, gentler people. It's very, very difficult to address the issues of gender equality in the music industry and the Me Too movement. And I think with what we're trying to do, we're trying to talk about it in a way that it doesn't so much promote inclusivity as it is inclusive. I would rather be rather than talk about being.
And yeah. Hey, it's so, not, hey guys, let's let the women in. It's let's make it a space where everyone's in.
And our conference is gender neutral. It's diverse. Everything we do, we're very focused on that and very deliberate about that to try to show the music industry that should be rather than the music industry, so to speak, that may be. Right now.
There's a whole lot of layers. And I mean, I've got text messages saying RRR and PBS have made an extraordinary contribution, but then public radio exists in other cities as well. Music promoters, you know, the influence of a single individual, whether it's a Gadinsky or a Molly Meldrum, can't be just swept aside either. They can make an extraordinary contribution just from the sheer force of their personality or their entrepreneurial spirit too.
I think when we talk to cities around the world, the first thing that we say is most cities don't know what they have because every city has more than they think they do. If you have people, you're a music city because people listen to and make music. The term music city is every city is a music city. I live in London. That's very much a music city. But every suburb of London, every city, you know, and
Liverpool's a music city.
Liverpool's, well, obviously Liverpool is, in Manchester, and where I'm from as well, and grew up in Canada, all those cities, Hamilton in near Toronto. But the first thing that every city needs to do is to count everything and map it. Melbourne does this. Melbourne did a census. Understanding all of these assets, we would call them assets, across your music city is so important to recognizing the deficiencies within it. So Melbourne doesn't do everything right. No one does everything right. But it does a lot right. And so what we try to do when we have you know, cities from many, many countries at our event, we're just trying to say the first thing is please count, map it, what we call asset mapping, and understand what you have.
There's some really interesting things happening too in the music industry now that things are a bit more decentered and a bit more online. And there's a woman called Hannah Donnelly that, Danielle, you mentioned in your book, in the context of decolonising the languages that we use around Australian landscapes. She's an Australian Indigenous DJ and she makes playlists and disseminates them of young Indigenous artists. And it's just kind of completely outside the commercial music making system. And I find that really exciting. Do you see things like that happening where people are just going, I'm going to take this into my own hands?
Well, that's the most exciting thing that can possibly happen, because you look around you and you say, this is not for me. This is not my scene. What's the best response to that? To create your own scene. But then part of the discussion that we're having in this conference is how can these scenes be facilitated or at least not suppressed by the power structures? And these are political issues. They're social issues. They're gender. And as you've just brought up, also racial issues. And it's very complicated, but actually can just be summed down to let people do what they want to do.
Plan for fun is what we always say. It's very, very important to never be prescriptive, as in my opinion, as a policymaker, but especially in arts and culture. We would never profess for anyone to do anything deliberate about the music that they choose to make or the music that they choose to listen to. Our objective is that music in and of itself is needs to be at least brought into parity with other issues in city planning and city placemaking, as we would call it, in our urban environment.
I think we also have to remember to actually, you're still talking about measuring music, we also have to measure the inherent biases in what we listen to and who we listen to and who we play on the radio or who we promote, because we tend to fall into habits like we do with writing, like we do in science, like we do in I'm sure in music, where we listen to certain voices more than others. And I think it's really important that we're just aware of that, and we're aware of who we're listening to and go, hey, hang on, there's no women in this conference, or we're not playing, you know, we're not playing the same number of female artists as we are male artists, and just having that awareness and that constant conversation about who's being listened to makes us step away a little bit from our biases and assumptions, and offers that open playing field that doesn't actually exist.
Yeah, that's a very good point, and I grappled with this a lot in the Monofoma MOFO Festival, is that there are not perceived to be as many prominent headlining female musicians and so forth. But then I realize it's because they haven't been given the chance. So I just started to proactively book a lot more female artists. And lo and behold, they ended up to be the ones that really won the audience's hearts over on the day, even if they may have been slightly underrated going into the show.
So having some leadership and civic leadership, you can't expect town hall, city hall, whatever it might be, to do all of this. There's a concept that you promote, Shane, of having a nightmare for a city. Not a nightmare, as in one word, but a mayor for the night.
Yes.
A night mayor, yes, who is basically the champion of the nightlife of the city. Have they done that anywhere?
Yeah, in a number of cities around the world. So let's... You know, it doesn't have to be called Nightmare. There are about 30 cities around the world that do this. The largest cities would be New York and London. with many people. I worked on the creation of the London one, which we call the Night Czar. And there's two ways, so we call it, there are two ways to do it. One is to focus on what's called nightlife, and then the second is to focus on what and I take from the Night Czar of London, what she calls life at night, which is different. Lots of people work at night in hospitals, mm-hmm. minicabs, so on and so forth. And we see that workers' rights, for example, are not what they are at night versus what they are during the day. So cities like Amsterdam and Berlin have taken an approach to creating a voice for nightlife in City Hall. So stopping things from happening doesn't mean they're not going to happen. I think that we've learned that in Sydney. And we have to understand that the nighttime economy, people experience it in different ways. While people, some people want to sleep, some people want to go out, some people go to work. And the Anglo-Saxon planning system that Australia sits under, UK sits under, is an 8 till 6. It's a retail planning system. So what we say is we proactively plan during the day and then we reactively license at night.
What a great idea. I love that. I hope that gets picked up on.
So, yes.
We've had some mayors who have been nightmares, mind you. But Brian Ritchie is a shakuhachi player and was with the Violent Femmes. He's now the music curator at the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart and single-handedly is making Hobart a music city. Shane Shapiro is the founding and managing director of Sound Diplomacy. They're over here for a conference. It's called Music Cities Convention. It takes a village to make a music city, and it's presented by Sound Diplomacy, Triple R, Music Victoria and Creative Victoria. It's at the Arts Centre and Fed Square tomorrow and Friday. Music Cities Convention, if you want to know more about it. And Brian's also got Dark Mofo coming up with Laurie Anderson, amongst others, in Hobart in June, which should be great. And thank you for coming in. Daniel Clode's book, The Wasp and the Orchid. Hillary's been my co-host. Thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.